WAMU 88.5 at American University in Washington. Welcome to the Politics Hour, starring Tom Sherwood. This staff of the show is completely out of control. Are you aware of that? You heard the music that we began with?
Yes,
Halloween music. They're all walking around here dressed in Halloween outfits. I didn't recognize anybody when I walked in this morning.
You realize that Halloween is a bigger thing for adults these days in terms of money and all that that's spent than it is for the little children.
Well, we don't have any adults who actually work on this show, so I think the children here are having a really good time. Oh, Tom Sherwood is our resident analyst. He's a reporter with the NBC4 and a columnist with the Current newspapers. Tom Sherwood, welcome.
Happy Halloween.
Inquiring minds want to know, when are you and Mary Che going to get the D.C. flag tattoo that you both promised to get here last week? After we went off the air, a contributor came up with the $3,000 that we were asking for, that we all said we would get
DC flag tattoos. The way you asked that question sounded like you had backed out.
I was pretending to have backed out, but okay. I fully intend to get the tattoo. But you first. When will you be getting it?
Well, I think we're going to try to arrange it. I've talked to Mary Che's staff, and I'm talking to you. I don't know. Are we going to man up and do this in person? My son says it hurts a little.
You know,
this all came about because my son has a D.C. flag tattoo. He has since 2004. I suggested I would do one if someone gave $5,000, and Michael Martinez, the producer of the show, has been browbeating me not to back out. And finally, last week, you know, somebody offered $3,000. So I think we're going to do it. I think we should do it on the mall.
We're going to coordinate it. We're going to video stream it and make sure that everybody knows exactly when and especially where we get these
tattoos. Do you know where you're going to have yours?
I know, but I'm not revealing this at this point. This is a family broadcast.
Ooh. Ooh, well, tune in.
Let's make sure Kevin Donahue.
Maybe we can get more money for that.
Kevin Donahue joins us in studio. He is D.C.'s Deputy City Administrator and Deputy Mayor for Public Safety and Justice. Kevin Donahue, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
When are you getting your D.C. tattoo?
I was saying, when I agreed to come on, I wasn't aware of getting a tattoo as part of the deal.
It's becoming a part of the new thing.
So, do you have a tattoo now?
I do not.
You're such a mild-mannered person. We'll get into that later, but...
So we are going to have to do a tattoo.
You know, mild-mannered people are the ones who actually have the tattoos.
Metro has a new general manager, Tom Sherwood. He's negotiating even as we speak. I don't know why these negotiations take so long with one person, but he's negotiating. Neil Cohen has a history of being in the, well, people in Maryland and Virginia and the district wanted a financial turnaround expert. In Virginia, they said they wanted somebody who had dealt with public transportation. He has not dealt with public transportation, but he has been in the transportation business because Neil Cohen served as an airline executive for Northwest and U.S. Airways. He also, however, has been involved in financial management with whom, Tom? You covered the story.
The aerospace industry. He's the out-of-this-world candidate.
Orbital ATK, an aerospace manufacturer and defense industry company. He was their chief financial officer. What else do we know?
U.S. Airways, another airline. He's an out-of-the-box choice for the Metro Board, the four-member search committee, and they're still talking to him. They're wrapping up a couple of the details. They expect to vote on this next Thursday, the next Metro Board meeting. 30 years in the airline industry, manufacturing, Northwest Airlines, and I'm looking at my notes now.
Yes.
He supposedly, according to everyone who's spoken about him so far, and some people are not speaking publicly, even though they like him, he has a clear head with numbers and what he can and can't do. The union should be a little nervous because he's dealt firmly with unions in the past, but... he's going to step onto a very big stage. He's been very in an important industry or important industries, but he's never been in the public eye. Several people don't even know him. And so this is going to be very important when he steps out on the public stage on next Thursday.
Kevin Donahue, do you know Neil Cohen?
I don't. A little known fact is I worked at Metro for about 10 months. It was a while ago, but I don't know him. I just know what I've read.
You know, if I may just brag for a moment on Adam Tuss from NBC4, who broke the story Wednesday.
Yes.
I must say we were working on this story Tuesday night. I was at the high heel race in Georgetown where the mayor was, and Jack Evans is on the search committee for Metro was, and I was like badgering them and John Falcicchio, the mayor's chief of staff, to try to find out who it was. But we found out on Wednesday. This was one of the biggest things in the region, whether this person's successful or not. Jim Deniger of the Board of Trade had said, this is the spine, this is the circulatory system of the region, transportation. If we're going to grow, we have to move people. I just can't wait to see this guy get in there. And as a citizen of the region, I hope that he's successful.
How long do you think his honeymoon period will last?
It won't be one. I told someone today, I said, he better be ready. He's been in the background, and on Thursday when he stands before the reporters, Adam Tuss and Martin DeCaro from this station and others, he better be ready to answer questions. We won't take this corporate stuff that they give out.
In case you're just joining us, our guest is Kevin Donahue, who is D.C.'s Deputy City Administrator and Deputy Mayor for Public Safety and Justice. If you have questions or comments for him, give us a call at 800-433-8850. You can send email to kojo@wamu.org, send us a tweet at Kojo Show, or go to our website, kojoshow.org. Watch the live video stream of the broadcast there. You can also submit your questions or comments there. Kevin Donahue, a dance-off between a D.C. police officer and a teenager. D.C. seems to know how to handle some interactions with teenagers, at least compared to South Carolina, and at least in this
go ahead.
Please, let's not go there. How are district D.C. officers being trained to address community concerns about police and to ensure accountability?
Well, part of it starts with D.C. recruits has a pretty high bar for who they recruit. And put them through a lot of training. And
have to be a college graduate in this city, right?
A college graduate, or replace that with a number of years in military or other law enforcement. And everyone, even if you've served as a law enforcement officer elsewhere, you have to go through almost the whole academy. And so the culture of the department, the tactics and the training start with that base. And then it's the leadership and the direction of the department has for many years been to try to interact with the community. Interactions with the community lead to better public safety. Now, this is a spontaneous decision on the part of one officer, a really wonderful one. It was filmed.
Wasn't that spontaneous? She knew how to do the nene dance.
Well, the decision to do it was spontaneous.
She was called for service for teenage women who might have been about to get into a fight, and she walked up there, and I think the decision to dance may have been unique, but the notion of your role is to de-escalate, that's where the training comes in. Now, she knew dance moves.
She did.
And she knew how to match dance move for dance move.
She did.
But it was coming from a good place that I think is in people who don't know how to dance too, which is that when you come to a scene, if you can, you are to de-escalate. And
that's the key word in police training that a lot of people lose. And I know this city has pushed de-escalation. I can give credit to D.C. Auditor Kathy Patterson, who was a council member in Ward 3 a decade ago, who had all the public hearings about the police department and the training and the way they were treating the mass protests and rounding people up and mm-hmm. hog-tying them and all of that. That was a terrible thing, a terrible image for the city. And since then, we've avoided a great deal of that.
De-escalate is the key word for you. Nene dance are the key words for me, because Sherwood and Mary Chan and I will be doing that while we're getting our D.C. flag tattoo.
Do men also do the nene dance?
We can work on it.
I haven't seen any.
We can learn.
But, of course, I wouldn't recognize it anyway. So.
Work as well over radio.
We'll be doing it on live on video stream. Your title is Deputy City Administrator and Deputy Mayor for Public Safety and Justice. It's my understanding that Mayor Muriel Bowser rolled those two jobs into one. So what are your primary responsibilities?
My primary responsibility is public safety. Now, the story of it is that I was originally hired as the Deputy City Administrator, which means I have a portfolio that covers operational agencies and public safety agencies.
About 70 agencies all over. There are about 70 agencies.
There are about 60 agencies, about 44 report to the mayor, a bunch of other independent. But there's also a law that calls for her to be a public safety deputy mayor. I had the portfolio. I also had prior relationships working with Chief Lanier. And so I wound up having two hats, but the reality of my day-to-day is that it's very public safety focused.
Violent crime and the homicide spike, major issues the District of Columbia is grappling with, including your office. Part of your job description as Deputy City Administrator includes a data-driven approach to improving government operations and overseeing public safety agencies. You directed that CAPSTAT program that was launched under Mayor Fenty, which Mayor Bowser said earlier this year that she's going to revive. Remind us what that is and whether it is once again a focus of your department.
It is. So I ran a program called CAPSTAT, and what that meant is a fancy term for we take a problem, we bring everyone into one room that touches that issue in government, which really means people working in agencies that you wouldn't think address the issue, but some part of it does. And we look at data to have a discussion about what we're doing well and, most importantly, where the gaps are. Now, the role data plays, and this plays in my work now, is that it's important for us to have discussions that are grounded in some factual basis, some not discussion or decisions based on anecdote or hearsay, but if you say something is a certain way, what's the data say and can you prove it? So when we look at crime, when we look at ambulance availability, any issue in public safety, the data isn't an end unto itself, but we want to make sure if we're making important decisions that those decisions are made on some common basis of fact.
One of the most controversial aspects of the mayor's proposal, I don't know, 20 different proposals in her crime package, is the warrantless search. And I think the police chief referred to data about that there are a certain number of people within who've been involved or convicted of violent crimes who are then re-involved again, and that this was a proposal that would, in the narrow circumstances, allow officials to go and search the homes of people who were on probation as part of their being on probation or out of jail, that they would allow these searches. And you got 100% pushback on that, so it looks like that's not going to happen. Is there anything that we're missing on that subject?
Let me sort of clarify the characterization of it. So this is, when we look at the data, what we see is that, you know, we've arrested 21 people, have been arrested for murder while under parole or probation. We've seen an increase in the number of people.
21
individuals,
okay,
of about 50 who have been arrested this year. This is not, I should start by saying, this is not about the reentry community and population. This is about individuals who have been convicted of a violent felony. So they've been convicted of murder, of rape, of shooting someone, of aggravated assault. And when there's reason to extend what happens now, and so it's not police searching, as part of the consent, what would happen is that a parole officer goes into a home now. They go in without a warrant to verify someone is at the home.
Unannounced?
It doesn't have to be unannounced. If there's a gun in plain sight, they can confiscate it. So this would be a tool really given to the parole officers to use at their discretion to extend that search and that look from the common space into the living quarters. And this is, as you said, it's part of one title in a 14-title bill that ranges from this all the way to having a work release program for misdemeanors so they can keep their jobs. And part of the thing I'd like to highlight is that the legislation, we sat down and looked at what are the gaps that exist. Not all of them are solved by legislation, but when they can be, let's do it. And it can have an impact more immediately. We tried to find those things, and so we put together a package that did range from extending these accountability tours, which we did get pushback on, all the way to things, and I say most of the things in there are things that we have not gotten pushback on, that cover the waterfront of intervention, reentry, and when we have seen reason, enhanced accountability.
I've noticed that, you know, we continue to have something like 40% more homicides this year than last year. But I've noticed that the news media has fallen off actually covering some of the homicides. Have you noticed that?
I think the other day on the Post, I think you had an A1 story, right, and most of B1 devoted to public safety. I don't think that's the case, and I certainly know that hasn't. The media attention has never driven how we look at it and what we look
Part
at.
Part of it was that, you know, somebody was shot on 7th Street just en route somewhere. The innocent victim kind of crimes does create more media coverage.
It does, but I would say
doesn't change what you do.
It doesn't change what we do. It really doesn't.
Talk about some of the other approaches this administration is taking to address the crime spike and how are you taking into account tensions between police and residents?
Sure. Let me answer those as two questions.
Sure.
Not that they're inherently unrelated, but some of the other approaches that we – one thing the mayor has given a charge to her cabinet is that she views everyone's job, no matter where you work or what agency you're with, as having a role in public safety. So we had some excess revenue and some underspending at the end of our fiscal year, about $23 million. All of that money is being directed in what we call a supplemental budget to be spent on public safety. None of it is actually going to police because a lot of agencies and some of the gaps that we've seen are what other agencies can do.
Preventive.
So $6.5 million of that is actually going to a jobs and training program where we've asked our supervision agencies to identify high-risk individuals under high-intensity supervision to be the people that we want to enroll in this program. So if we have training opportunities, we connect that to trying to have an effect on safety. $8 million went to testing evidence at our crime lab that has literally been sat untested. And this is evidence of open cases with victims still waiting for justice. So we've tried...
Not to mention alleged perpetrators still waiting for justice.
Yeah, absolutely. Yes, we're victims waiting for perpetrators to be brought to justice.
Okay.
And so when we look at crime, it's important to realize that it's not just myself, the police chief, and the mayor at the table. We have our departments of behavioral health, of human services, of employment services at the table every week talking about what we can all do.
You mentioned Department of Employment Services. There's an initiative called the Summer of Service Mini-Grants targeting youth. What are those?
Those are when I've gone out to community meetings, one thing that is evident is that you have individuals who are really acting as providing service to communities that have been traumatized by crime. And so we identified about $1.2 million spread across. We picked the five communities that have been traumatized by the most violence. And mini grants means that we can get the money out quickly. They're relatively small amounts. And the intention is to give money to individuals or groups who are already in the community, already have the relationships, doing violence mediation, providing after-school and evening programs, which all play a role in public safety. And the mini refers to their size and the speed at which we think we can get them out so we can see action on the ground happening.
On this subject, and you mentioned the $6 million, I think it was, in part for employment, getting people jobs. I have on this program many times talked about the Department of Employment Services and how it has a bewildering number of programs and pass-through of federal monies to organizations that supposedly are doing teaching, job training. But I don't know of any CAPSTAT statistics that would tell me X number of people got jobs, X number of people have those jobs after 6 months, which is one of the standards for deciding whether you've really got a job or not. And it seems to me that the Department of Employment Services is one of the foot draggers in the centipede of response to crime. How do we know that Department of Employment Services is doing anything other than hiring the people who run the employment agencies?
Foot draggers in the centipede of response?
How about that? Write that down. But, you know, there's a centipede of response, and every agency has to be responsible for public safety. Well, Department of Employment Services is a big one, but no one has yet to show me statistics that it actually does anything.
I'm happy to come back at another show and go into that. It's actually the first cap stat the mayor had was on focusing really on the vendors. So our Department of Employment Services, which are, if they're on the centipede, they're at the front of the centipede because of the role that they play. We ask the same tough questions, and we still do around. We know.
Do you have the answers yet?
Well, we know.
I know it's new.
We know that there are programs out there where we're seeing more success than others. When I say less success, I mean when we're seeing a program train individuals and see less than half of those individuals getting jobs, we have to ask tough questions about the vendors. The intention when we go in any jobs program now is to evaluate, much like the federal government's Department of Labor does, evaluate the impact, and looks at whether or not the people receiving the service are in fact having jobs they did not have before, having their incomes go up as a result of the training. And so that is, I'd say, an emphasis of what we're trying to do at DOES. And it's been a long time coming, and asking those tough questions about the vendors that are receiving taxpayer money.
And Rebecca, one subject, can we have year-round summer jobs programs rather than, so the young people are active 12 months a year rather than 6 weeks?
We are now. And so when I said there's $6.5 million that we set aside, about four of that was in fact to have a year-round program focused on really 20 to 24-year-olds. So individuals who are at an age where they're probably not in school anymore. And can we give them training? Can we give them jobs that allow them to look for other jobs? So that's actually, most of that money is going to exactly that.
Good.
We got a tweet from Charles Holman who asked, why would a warrantless search be better than a warranted search? If someone is dangerous, a warrant shouldn't be a problem.
Warrants aren't problems. We do searches with warrants on a regular basis. And this is, we deploy search warrants when the police are going into homes. The intention behind this part of the legislation is not to give a privilege to police they don't have anymore. It's actually to give a tool to the parole officers who have often very good relationships with the individuals and with the individuals and households they're living in to essentially extend what they're doing now into the living quarters. It's, if they would ask for the police to be present to confiscate a weapon, police would, but this would not be giving police a power they don't have. Police only go into a home and will only go into a home with a search warrant.
Put on your headphones, please, because Scott in Washington, D.C. has a question for you. Scott, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Hi, good afternoon. I want to commend you for the work you're doing to help with jobs opportunities for people who have come back into the community.
Thank you. But the deputy mayor, deputy city administrator, is also listening. Go ahead, please.
Yes. So I wanted to thank him for the work he's doing. But the biggest challenge is CSOSA. CSOSA doesn't offer job training. It doesn't even offer job placement. And therefore, it leads to more violation for people going back to jail rather than getting jobs and being reintegrated in the community. What is the city and specifically your office doing to help with that?
For those who don't know what CSOSA is, it is the Court Services and Offender Supervision Agency.
And it's essentially our adult parole and probation agency.
Thank you.
And when I say our, it serves our community. It's run by the federal government, so it's not part of the 60 agencies that, Tom, you mentioned. It's a good question. When we decided to do a year-round program, that sort of a year-round summer youth program focused on 20 to 24-year-olds, we actually have given 200 of the 400 slots, so half of all the slots we have turned over to CSOSA, and they have a partner called Pretrial Services, who we have great partnerships with and, quite frankly, have a really good sense of where the need is. So to the extent we're able to fund additional slots, we took half of them and said, please refer people to the program to fill half these slots. And that, you know, half of 400 is not addressing the full need, but we think it's a step in the direction that we want to go into the future.
Do you think the District of Columbia government, since 1974, a home rule government, do you think it should run this program? The criminal justice and the judges are still appointed by the president. The prosecutions are done by the U.S. Attorney's Office. Isn't it time for the district to have big boy pants on and actually run its own criminal court justice system?
You know, I start questions like that with what problem are we trying to solve? And so where we have good cooperation, you know, you can have great cooperation or lack of communication for people sitting next to you at work or being in the same department. As long as we have good cooperation, I don't think the inherent fact that it's federal necessarily matters. We do have good cooperation. With all the problems that I have to solve, I don't try to look for problems that aren't there.
Well, the mayor and the chief, Mayor Bowser and Chief Lanier, at that event several months ago in Southeast, the mayor specifically said she wanted to meet with or talk with the U.S. attorney. now it's a new one, Channing Phillips, about what the prosecutors can do to overcome this, as you know, this thing where the prosecutors say the police department doesn't give us enough information to go forward. The police say we give them enough. They don't go forward because they don't want to be wasting their time on these issues. Are you working better with the prosecutors? Have you even met with Channing Phillips yet?
I have not personally met with them. I know the police chief has. I have met many times with the U.S. attorney, the outgoing U.S. attorney, Vince Cohen, and with his team. The most important part of what you talked about, and this was a common question at a 500-person community meeting on Capitol Hill this week, which is people want to know when there's an arrest made, what happens? Is the person prosecuted? Are they not? And as the deputy mayor for public safety, my interest is partly to know when you're not moving forward, what can we learn to do better? And a lot of those relationships are not the principals. It's getting the detectives and the prosecutors to be sharing how each can work better together.
Speaking of prosecutors, we've got one coming up on this broadcast. Angela Alsobrooks, the Maryland State's Attorney for Prince George's County. Kevin Donahue, thank you so much for joining us. Kevin Donahue is D.C.'s Deputy City Administrator and Deputy Mayor for Public Safety and Justice. Since those two jobs have been combined, are you going to end up with one title at some point, or are you going to be two deputies for the entire administration?
I'll have two titles for the entire administration.
One salary.
If you think my scope is big, you should see my boss's scope.
Who's your boss
Yeah,
again?
But she ran for that job.
Yes.
You were just hired.
Well, You're Kevin Donahue, once again, thank you so much for joining us. As we said, coming up is Angela Alsobrooks. She's the Maryland State's Attorney for Prince George's County. Before we get to Maryland, let's go to Virginia for a second time because there's elections coming up there next week on Monday on this broadcast. WAMU 88.5's Virginia reporter Michael Pope will be joining us to talk about the importance of those elections. But I guess what's really important for Democrats in the Commonwealth of Virginia is when they can take back, if they can take back the Senate. It'll only take one victory in the Senate races for them to increase their membership because they'll be able to, because of course they have that other vote. They'll be able to.
I'll save you from this. It's not just important for the Democrats. It's important for the Republicans to maintain or expand their control. And this
because
is
they
an
already have control. Yes.
Yes, and this is that is the crucial issue in Virginia. The governor was here, and in other places.
And he's out and campaigning.
And there are anti-gun organizations that are supporting some of the Democratic candidates, making gun control an issue. There are abortion issues. But yes, I would just like to say in general, because not only in Virginia, which is the heart of where most of the elections are, but there are elections in Maryland too. There are several races for mayor in College Park, which is about to undergo a huge amount of construction and redevelopment. There are real questions about who the candidates are there. The Post had an interesting story today. I'll let you read. But there are elections, so I would just urge people. Our cities, our counties, our states are only as good as the people active in them. And people really ought to think about this. And if you're in Maryland and Virginia, you really ought to go vote on Tuesday. There's some really big issues in the state of Virginia particularly and in the cities of Maryland where there are elections.
And as you pointed out, there are issues that have to do with transportation and tolls, issues having to do with abortion in some of these races. There's a lot to look at. And as I said, we'll be having Michael Pope on come Monday to discuss them. The Pepco Exelon proposed merger, the D.C. Public Service Commission is apparently open to hearing what was struck in the deal with Mayor Muriel Bowser and Pepco Exelon taking another look at it. It does appear that the chances for its approval this time might be better.
Well, I don't know if that's, I would say there's, well, the Public Service Commission, Betty Ann Kane is the chairman, they decided they would accept a revised proposal rather than making the two entities, Pepco and Exelon, start all over from the beginning. Right. So that takes what would have been maybe another 6 months or even a year down to maybe a couple of months. I'm not so sure that this improves the prospects for Pepco Exelon because the decision by the chairman that she read said that this merger didn't show any real benefit for the citizens and the customers of Pepco. There's some short-term money. The sweeteners went from about $14 million to $78 million. But the long-term of whether Exelon, which is an old-style energy company, and Pepco, which can be a cash cow for it, whether that's really good for the consumers in the city, that question has not been answered, and I expect the Public Service Commission to answer that just more quickly than we thought.
Well, the fact that the Office of the People's Counsel has signed on to it, does that make a difference?
Well, I think that helps in that the People's Counsel went ahead. But again, all the improvements in the proposal are simply short-term. They expire in about 2 or 3 years. And we're talking about decades of who's going to provide power to this city as it grows. And that's a big issue. It's not just a few lollipops handed out at the beginning.
If you have questions or comments for Angela also Brooks, please call us now at 800-433-8850. She is the Maryland State's Attorney for Prince George's County. She joins us in studio. Angela also Brooks, thank you very much for joining us.
Well, thank you for having me.
You can also watch our live video stream at kojoshow.org. Ask questions or make comments there. Send email to kojo@wamu.org or tweet at Kojo Show. Prince George's Police Chief Mark McGaw said yesterday that the county is losing officers to retirement faster than they can be replaced. He's asked for funds for more recruits, but the county is in the midst of a budget battle. How big a priority is this for you and for the county?
Oh, it's a huge priority for us. I mean, there's nothing more important than public safety. I think we can all acknowledge that, that it drives everything that happens in our communities, from how we live to which businesses invest in our community. And so investing in public safety is huge. The officers in our county have done, I think, an amazing job. We've had about 1,700 officers patrolling a county with nearly 1 million people in it, and they have done so with crime declines over the last 4 years that we haven't seen since the late 70s. We need to sustain the number of officers we have. We can scarcely afford to lose any of them.
And this is a problem in the District of Columbia where officers are retiring. Even the chief, Lanier, told me one day, she said, every officer that she has in her command staff is eligible to walk out the door.
Wow.
And that's true, and you do have a big change. And while crime is down in Prince George's County, homicides are not.
They are not down, and we have been concerned about this. We are working. We understand why this is happening, which is helpful. But nonetheless, it is alarming for us, and we are working to make sure that we change the trend as far as homicides are concerned.
Have you been able to identify any issues with attracting new recruits to Prince George's County Police?
None that I'm aware of. I think that, you know, that would be something that the chief would be able to speak more intelligently to. But I know that people want to come to Prince George's County. We obviously have a police department which has a great reputation. The leadership there is very well known. The chief is a person who is respected across the country. I can't imagine there's anyone who wouldn't want to come to work for our police department.
The change in the Prince George's Police Department from, say, 30 or 40 years ago is just remarkable.
It is remarkable.
It used to be known as the brutal police department in this region. It's a big difference there.
I think the community acknowledges the difference. I can certainly tell you the difference. I've grown up in Prince George's County, and I can tell you this is not the same relationship I grew up knowing with our police department, but it's taken a lot of work. Our community really deserves a lot of credit for engaging. They didn't sit back. They have engaged us. They come really, it's amazing how often they come out to meet with us each month. They come.
Do
to
any of your
us.
Officers, excuse me, do the nay-nay, the dance?
I bet they do. We have one who jumps double dutch. Did you see our officer jumping
I've
double dutch?
That. I have seen
and
that.
And that's not
jumping.
Easy to do. So really? We have a very talented force, I have to tell you, more talented than any across the country.
Earlier this week, President Obama addressed chiefs of police from across the nation to talk about some of the challenges given tensions between law enforcement and African-American communities. Prince George's County has seen its share of that tension, including black and other minority residents demanding more police accountability. How is the county working to address those issues?
Well, we've worked in our office, for example. We have a special prosecution unit that we started in 2011 after I was elected. That unit looks exclusively at cases involving police officers and shootings. We have really enjoyed a relationship not only with the community, but we've had cooperation from our police department, which means that when things have not gone well, we have not only been able to address those issues and prosecute where it was appropriate, but I'm proud to say we've done so. And in each instance, the chief of police stands with me to make sure that he sends the message that we will not tolerate that sort of conduct in our county. But I believe that we, the community, if you could talk to them, because I have an opportunity to talk to them on a regular basis, I believe they understand that things happen. We're not saying we're perfect, but they know that we are unafraid to confront
You mentioned if we could talk to them, we will be talking to them. We'll be discussing the Black Lives Matter movement in Prince George's County at our upcoming Kojo in Your Community in Hyattsville on the evening of November 17th. It's free and open to the public. You can find out more about that at wamu.org/events. Addressing gun violence is a nationwide debate right now. Last Saturday was the first gun show in Prince George's County since Maryland's new gun restrictions took effect. Some vendors skipped the show because of those new rules. What are Maryland's restrictions?
Well, Maryland's restrictions are a little different than across the country. We have unilateral background check requirements, which means that unlike many other states, private individuals are required to conduct background checks as well as others. We do not have those requirements for long guns. Those apply to handguns only. But Maryland is slightly different in that we do universally require background checks even at those gun shows.
Do you think there's any expectation with all the politics going on this year, particularly in Virginia, but then next year with the presidential race? Do you see any real hope that there will be background checks? I mean, some people have fought just aggressively against this thing, and it's just if you do this, then you'll do something else, and then suddenly the right to bear arms will be eliminated. Do you see some kind of national background check requirement ever passing?
You know, we certainly hope so. I think all the data is there that explains why we need it. You know, for example, in Prince George's, if we look at homicides this year alone, 70% of our homicides are committed using handguns. I think that it's becoming increasingly difficult to turn a blind eye to what we're seeing with the mass shootings across the country, many with individuals who suffer from mental illness. We have to do something, and I believe that and hope that at some point it will become impossible to ignore the inevitable, which is that we must do something to address more aggressively.
Mr.
Our guest is Angela Alsobrook. She's the Maryland State's Attorney for Prince George's County. If you have questions or comments for her, call now at 800-433-8850 or send email to kojo@wamu.org.
Mr. Donahue of the district was here talking about cap stats and keeping statistics. Do you have a sense in the county where did the guns come from? Well, I know it's a chance to bash Virginia if we want to, but often that's what the city says, they come from Virginia. But do you have any real substantive information about where do the guns come from? Are they legal?
Well, what we know is that the majority of the guns used in our cases are illegally obtained, and that's part of what we've tried to address even through the Firearm Safety Act that was passed in Maryland, is these straw purchasers are a problem. These are not legal gun owners, but these are individuals who sell guns to disqualified individuals, and that is what we are trying to stop. One of the things
Is that a crime now for someone to buy a gun and then give it to someone else or sell it to someone else?
Oh, absolutely. It is. It is illegal to do that, and that is what we've tried to stop with the Firearm Safety Act is, you know, requiring fingerprints, for example, now for individuals who purchase guns to make sure that they are accountable, that we know where the guns come from. When we capture your fingerprint, it's not foolproof, but we're trying to do more to make sure that we are not allowing this undermarket to continue.
Donald Trump said he carries a gun. He packs heat sometimes.
Oh, my goodness. Well, that among other problems with Donald.
There have been a rash of domestic violence-related homicides in Prince George's, some recent cases that have made headlines, but this uptick has been ongoing at least last year, 2014. What are the numbers now, and what has the trend been in Prince George's County?
Well, this year we have 11 of our 60 homicides have been domestic in nature, and last year we ended with 19 of our 54 were domestic in nature, and this is a trend that to say it's problematic is an understatement. It is sickening what we have seen in our cases. Many of them involve children who have either witnessed the crime. We have children who have been victims of the crimes. It is a very, it is a disturbing and just heartbreaking trend that we've seen. We had 7 of our 19 domestic victims last year were children 3 and under. This is something that must stop.
It's Domestic Violence Awareness Month, but for you, this is an issue that you focus on 12 months a year. What's your office doing to bring attention to the issue?
Well, we just hosted on October 17th a summit we call the Family Strong Experience. We hosted that at the First Baptist Church of Glen Arden, where we brought out resources, including mental health advocates and individuals who could offer screening and offer information for families who needed assistance. We do this, as you have mentioned, year-round. We've met with pastors in Prince George's and in Washington, D.C. to train them to recognize the signs of domestic violence, to educate couples and individuals who come to them for assistance. So we don't wait. We are tired of reacting and really have been in a posture of trying to prevent more of it from happening. It's too late. Once someone's dead or injured, we are really trying to do what we can to prevent this from happening in the first place.
What are the strategies for addressing what you see as the underlying issues, as you pointed out, before the tragedy occurred? That's obviously a much tougher nut to crack.
It is. And you know what? I'm going to tell you, the underlying issue is that we have destabilized families, that we have to do more and more to protect families and to support families and to get information to families about how to protect themselves. That, I find, really is the issue. Children who witness violence in their households will repeat it. We find that it's damage that really goes unseen for years. So we have to get to more families.
You said we have destabilized families. Exactly what do you mean by that, we have destabilized families?
What I mean by that is we've seen, for example, a number of children who have been killed in households by boyfriends who have been left with these children while the mothers go off to work. And this is some of what we're talking about, is not having enough support in families. These are working women who are going out attempting to work, who are leaving their children in the custody of people who kill them. This, in my mind, indicates a symptom of a larger problem, and that problem is that families...
You're saying there's a social basis for this public safety issue, and when we had Rashern Baker on this show a few weeks ago, he is, as you know, term limited. You sound like somebody who would like to address some of the broader issues in Prince George's County. When are you going to announce that you're running for county executive?
Well, you know what? I was just sworn in as the state's attorney for Prince George's County, Maryland, and I am doing my level best to do that job. And so it's way too early to do anything like that. I am the state's attorney, and I am working have been over the last 4 years to address these issues.
This week.
No, okay. Around families. This is not new. This is not new. The summit that we hosted on the 17th was our third summit. So we've been focused on this issue around families and youth and children really over the last 4 years, and we're not going to stop talking about
it. Are you also looking at mental health problems among men? Talk about that.
Oh, absolutely. What we know is that men are not comfortable asking for help, that our society has said to them that there's some shame associated with indicating that you need help, and we have been saying...
All right, man up. Man up. Don't show any weakness.
Something along those lines, which is ridiculous. And what we know is that we can't solve these problems by talking to one part of the family. We can't just talk to women and expect the problem to end. We have to talk to men. We have to talk to women. We have to talk to children. But say to men, if you need help, the same entities that offer help for women also offer help for men.
Allow me to interrupt for a second, because Barry in Germantown, Maryland, put on your headphones, please, wants to address precisely the issue you're discussing. Barry, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
The question that I had was simply to ask about the double-edged sword. You know, not only do you need the control of the guns, of course, but are the problems associated with the reasons why people use guns in the first place being looked at? In other words, are we going to provide financing to provide psychological services for people who, you know, finally end up using a gun to express their anger, anxiety, or whatever? So that's the first question.
I thank you, Barry, for that question, and I think you make a great point. And the point is that we need more help and counseling for individuals who suffer from mental illness. That's the point we've been making. I think most especially we need that help for children who are traumatized, who are suffering in many ways from things that they have seen in their homes. And by the time they get a gun in their hand, and they have no skills to deal with conflict resolution, they use those guns in ways that are destructive and deadly.
Tom?
What about last week, an Ogden Hill man, Malcolm Thomas, pleaded guilty, second-degree murder, August 2014, killing of an 83-year-old, I'm reading this, Eunice Brooks, and 50-year-old Janice Marshall, Tom. How much would it help if the news media, which is always jumps on crime as a news story, would do more to tell people what happens when people are taken to court? I mean, the horrible case in Virginia right now, we're waiting for the jury to decide on this man accused of three murders. But those kind of cases get media, but a lot of people don't realize that day in and day out, I get press releases from the U.S. Attorney's Office almost on a daily basis, at least five or six a week, saying this person got this many years. I just don't know if people ever hear the other end of the criminal justice system. Could we do better at that?
I mean, you know, absolutely. I guess we can always do better to get out information if we believe.
And we get the media to report it, even if you get it out.
Well, you know what? I think we do a great job reacting, in other words. So we are giving stiffer sentences. We are holding individuals accountable. I'm not sure that that's the complete solution.
Well, just, it's a way for if you were a young person and you didn't quite realize what's happening to people who do the things you're contemplating doing.
Yeah, so I think it can act as a deterrent. I think you just have to do both. To be firm, but to also go ahead and make sure that you're trying to prevent the crime. You know, when we talk about hearing about what happens after the crime, I think we ought to do more to prevent our children from watching and glorifying violence on television.
How are you going to do that?
Well, I think we have to reach parents.
Get a voluntary thing to turn the TV off or limit the program.
Explain to them the relationship between what these children see and how they behave.
Well, this is a politics hour. Let me ask you, you know, whoever represents Maryland in the Senate next year will help decide things like gun control issues and whatever. Are you taking a position in the Senate race with Chris Van Hollen and Donna Edwards?
You know, I haven't taken a position yet. I think we have two, outstanding individuals.
What about Elijah Cummings? If he gets in, congressman, he said he was going to get in. He said he would let us know after the Benghazi hearings, and those are wrapping up pretty quickly.
So then we'd have three, I think, really great candidates for Senate. We haven't, I have not taken a position in that,
yet.
Possible. It's possible that I will, but I haven't at this point.
I want to get back to the issue of domestic violence for a second, because there seem to be particular issues in different communities. Talk about some of the challenges addressing domestic violence in the Latino community.
We are concerned about what we're seeing in the Latino community for this reason. We believe that there are a good number of victims who are afraid to come forward and to talk to law enforcement because of the secured communities kind of concept that made people believe that if they came to law enforcement for help, they would be arrested for immigration consequences or for immigration reasons. And so it has really done a lot to destroy the relationship between law enforcement and the Latino community. And we have been working very diligently, including with this Family Strong experience. We brought in a band, for example, a Latino band, to sing in hopes of attracting Latino families so that we could get information to them about our services. And so this is a problem we're seeing, is that there is, of course, domestic violence occurring in Latino families, but in many instances they're reluctant to call for help.
Here now is Scott in Hyattsville, Maryland. Scott, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Yeah, I wanted to remind our audience, I believe the state's attorney has actually prosecuted two Prince George's County officers in the last year and got convictions for, striking suspects, stuff like that. Maybe more, I don't know. She can enlighten us maybe. But I did want to ask, she said at the beginning of the interview, we know why the murder rate has spiked in Prince George's, but we didn't get into the details. Could you explain, what do you know? Why has this spike occurred?
Well, I thank you, Scott, on both accounts. You're right. We do not tolerate, let me just make this clear, we do not tolerate officers who step over the line and assault citizens. And one of the things that we're proud of in the cases that you talked about is that the chief of police and the police department actually brought those two officers to us who struck handcuffed individuals, and we prosecuted them. When you talk about the murder rate and why we see it heading in the direction it is, it probably takes a whole nother segment to talk about it, but we believe marijuana, the decriminalization of marijuana, has really driven a lot of the violence that we have seen this year in Prince George's, in the homicides in particular. We believe this is absolutely what is happening in Prince George's, is as we have seen the demand driven. We now
have stats on that. I mean, that's really, given what the district has done, that's a big deal.
The district and Oregon and Washington.
Yeah, but for the district, I mean, that's a. All the crimes you're seeing, there are too many.
Not all of the crimes.
Well, too many of the crimes have people who are on marijuana or using marijuana. Or,
well, what we are seeing is that we're fighting for turf with the marijuana dealers who are fighting.
People here would say if you legalize it, you wouldn't have that problem.
Well, you know, one of the issues we're seeing when we talk about violence is that because we no longer have the ability to search individuals who have small amounts of marijuana, we are, also concerned that we are having individuals who have possessed guns who are not searched, and we are not able to search incident to arrest and to recover guns. And so we have to find a new way to get some of the guns off the streets that we are concerned.
Well, the advocates for legal marijuana, one of the hardest sales they made in the district was that of the people who are arrested for minor marijuana crimes are African-American young men who don't need any additional problems for them. And that would be a problem, that the police would arrest young African-American men who were smoking marijuana, but not white people.
Well, you know what, from a law enforcement perspective, we do not encourage profiling, if that's what you're talking about. But I have to tell you that a couple of things are happening. First of all, where marijuana was concerned, we were long ago using diversion for marijuana cases that came into the state's attorney's office. And the other thing is I have seen too many lives destroyed by marijuana. I may as well go ahead and say it. I am so concerned about what I see with young people who are using marijuana, not only who are in our courtrooms for violent offenses because they are selling it, they are killing each other because of it, but they are also dropping out of school. It is a very big problem that we have to address as a community.
Angela Also Brooks is the Maryland State Attorney for Prince George's County. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you all for having me.
And whenever you get ready to announce that you're running for another office, please make sure you let us know.
Thank you.
Here is Nikki in Adams Morgan in Washington. Nikki, you got about 30 seconds. Go ahead, please.
Kodo, you have to let me tattoo you. You have to come to my tattoo shop to let me tattoo you. I would love to. I'm such a fan.
Would you also tattoo Tom Sherwood and Mary Che for me, please?
Of course I will, and all for free, because I would be thrilled. I've been listening for so many years. I'm a monthly contributor. I love NPR, and I love you guys, and I would love to.
We will add your name to the list of legitimate tattoo parlors who have made this offer so far.
We'll let people know what we're going to do so that everyone can so see that WAMU is on this case to get those tattoos done.
Angela Also Brooks, wait, we might have you get a tattoo also. No, I'm just kidding.
Oh, wow.
My
daughter would think I was super cool.
Do you have a tattoo?
No, I do not have a tattoo, but that would make my 10-year-old think I was a cool mommy.
Angela Also Brooks, Tom Sherwood, always a pleasure, and thank you all for listening. I'm Kojo Nandi.